Sekela and his band with Tim Lilla. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, November the 18th, and people in 12 states are trying to recover from a violent storm that triggered scores of tornadoes in the West and the Midwest yesterday. The death toll stands now at 6, but authorities fear that number will climb as towns begin to clear away debris and restore power. The wave of thunderstorms brought damaging winds and tornadoes to Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, Indiana, Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Western New York. The National Weather Service says that it expects the storm to move eastward into New England and Canada today, and with a lot less power.
Tale of the tape of this scandal that's going on right now.
So
there's no
that's
doubt that
good news on that score. The National Weather Service delivering good news today. And in the Philippines, where authorities say more than 3,600 people were killed and 2 million displaced by Typhoon Haiyan's ferocious winds and flash floods on November the 8th, international aid is pouring in and search and rescue efforts continue at a feverish pace. The sheer enormity of the disaster overwhelms emergency responders and available resources, but authorities are reporting progress in getting food, water, and medical attention to those desperately in need. Bad weather there, bad weather here. Well, yesterday we learned yet another thing about Obamacare. I'm calling it Obamacare because it's a kind of scary individual mandate healthcare reform thing that we must obey because, you know, it's the law and it's been sanctioned by the Supreme Court and all. Seems Democrats knew that millions of people would have their policies canceled. They would not be able to hold on to their old policies, as the president had said. Here's New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand on ABC's This Week with Martha Raddatz.
And now New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand joins us. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm going to ask you the same question. Can President Obama regain the trust of the American people?
Of course he can. Because, Martha, what this is about is everyday people needing access to affordable health care. They don't want their coverage dropped because of a pre-existing condition or when they get sick. They want their kids covered up to 26, and they want to have preventive care covered. And that's what this bill does. So once we get over this implementation issue, we will they can fix this. This is a fixable problem. So once they fix it, people will see I have an opportunity to cover my family. And Martha, I was in the emergency room just last week with my son who had an asthma attack and took too many puffs on his puffer. And I looked in the eyes of all the other mothers in the emergency room. These are mothers who don't have health care, who may not, this may be their only
but
access.
Whose trust has been shattered this
No, but
past
when,
month.
Once... That's just an implementation issue. Once you get beyond it, you then say, look,
and
oh,
you
my
think
God,
we'll get beyond it
you,
we by
will.
November 3rd.
You know what they'll see? Emergency room is covered. Do you know how much it is to go to an emergency room? You get a bill. It's very expensive.
Let me ask you this. I want to go back to this implementation because we can't quite go forward yet. Did you feel misled by Obama?
He should have just been more specific, because the point is, if you're being offered a terrible health care plan that the minute you get sick, you're going to have to go into bankruptcy, those plans should never be offered.
So were you misled?
He should have just been specific. No, we all knew. The whole point of the plan is to cover things people need, like preventive care, birth control.
So we all knew, she says. We all knew. That's what she said. All the Democrats knew, we all knew that the policies would be canceled. Isn't that interesting? Well, while Gillibrand was saying that the Democrats knew millions would lose their policies on ABC, she was talking, what do you say, is on NBC, on the other side of the coin, was NBC talking with Nancy Pelosi. And in the Caribbean, we have the saying that you tell an Anansi tale. Well, Nancy Pelosi was telling an Anansi tale over on NBC's Meet the Press. Democrats, she said, stand tall behind Obamacare. The 39 members who broke rank last Friday and voted for the Republican bill to let insurers keep selling policies that don't meet Obamacare requirements, a bill that faces almost certain death in the Democrat-controlled Senate, and in any event, Obama has threatened to veto. Of those Democrats, Pelosi said, this is political, so they respond politically. Real deep. You may recall my dismay some weeks ago about Ms. Pelosi. Just to refresh your memory, at the 2010 Legislative Conference for the National Association of Counties, she wouldn't, or maybe couldn't, say what exactly the Affordable Care Act was. Here's how she explained it to county officials.
We're very, you've heard about the controversies within the bill, the process about the bill, one of the items. But I don't know if you have heard that it is a legislation for the future, not just about health care for America, but about a healthier America, where preventive care is not something that you have to pay a deductible for or out of pocket, that prevention is about diet, not diabetes. It's going to be very, very exciting. But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it away from the fog of the controversy.
That we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what's in it. And she's talking to county officials, a National Association of County Officials, back in 2010. We have to pass the bill so that you could find out what's in it. Well, I want to thank in advance of this clip that you're about to hear, New York Party Guy. He put together this montage, and it's very amusing in a way. If it weren't so scary and sad, it really would be amusing. He captures many snippets from then-candidate Barack Obama, who was promising transparency for health care reform, pledging that there will be no more secrecy. No more secrecy. There will be a table, and everybody would be called to the table in the open, and not people who have to pay for a seat at the table, he says. And this was, of course, when he was running against Billary. That's Hillary and Bill Clinton together. They were running together in 2008. So Obama was very strident about this health care reform, and you would note, as the montage proceeds, you will hear the various digs that he had to say about the Billary plan. Let's listen to this lovely montage.
I'll make our government open and transparent so that anyone can ensure that our business is the people's business. When there's a bill that ends up on my desk as president, you, the public, will have 5 days to look online and find out what's in it before I sign it.
But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
You know, I respect what the Clintons tried to do in 1993 in moving health reform forward. But they made one really big mistake, and that is they took all their people and all their experts into a room, and then they closed the door. And they tried to design the plan in isolation from the American people.
But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
I will do it entirely differently. Within the first 100 days of my administration, we are going to have a big table, and everybody's going to be invited. Labor, employers, doctors, nurses, hospital administrators, patient advocate groups, the drug and insurance companies, they'll all get a seat at the table. They just won't get to buy every chair. And we will work on this process publicly. It'll be on C-SPAN. It will be streaming over the net.
But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
When there's a bill that ends up on my desk as president, you, the public, will have 5 days to look online and find out what's in it before I sign it.
But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
And find out what's in it before I sign it. And find out what's in it before I sign it.
But we have to pass the bill so that you can find out what is in it.
And we will work on this process publicly. It'll be on C-SPAN. It will be streaming over the net.
Because when I'm president, meetings where laws are written will be more open to the public. No more secrecy. That's a commitment I make to you as president. No more secrecy.
No more secrecy. Basically, this is an open question. Do you remember any table? Well, at least we got some more truths known. The president did say, did actually state the fact that the Clintons, especially Mrs. Clinton, the co-president, he used the word isolation. I used secrecy. Concocted this bill in secrecy. So Obama is clear. He's right on that score. And did you get to read about this bill 5 days before it was signed? I'm just taking a poll. I mean, he is trustworthy. He does tell the truth. He does keep his promises. So we were supposed to have been able to hear this on live stream, and we were supposed to hear it on C-SPAN, and we were supposed to have, a website. I don't want to use the word because I know it could be, it's a little touchy right now, but we were supposed to be able to see this bill, see it before he signs it. Did any of this happen? Do you recall any of this happening? I just thought I'd check because, you know, at my age, you know, the brain cells start to erode rapidly. And I just wanted to assure myself that I still have my two brain cells firing. They're still there. They're still holding on to a little memory. This is the putrid nature of politics. This man could say these things as a candidate, and he swears this was going to be the heart of his efforts at reform, reforming all kinds of things. And that's what he said he would do with healthcare. People will know in advance. He is absolutely for transparency. No secrecy around him. Absolutely not. And there is Nancy, who Obama has promised he will return to her glory should she desire it. She has already said she's not particularly interested, back to the leader of the House, because they expect to have more Democrats than Republicans in the House after the next election. Well, I did say on Friday that there's something coming down the pike. It's not being talked about at some point soon. It ought to be talked about because 21 states have said they are not expanding their Medicaid programs. Four still are on the fence. They have not decided which way they will go. So altogether, the 21 and the four make 25 states that simply have not come on board with this federal program, this mandated program. So come January the 1st, the question is, what happens to millions of people in these states who won't get Medicaid because these states are not accepting Medicaid funds to expand their Medicaid programs? What will happen to people, the millions of people in these states who cannot or who will not qualify for Medicaid and will not be able to afford health insurance, even if it was subsidized? That's a nice little question, and it's the big elephant standing in the middle of the room. I want to know. But that question has not yet been addressed, but expect that it will be a huge problem. And the problems, they will continue, because there's a lot more. There's a lot more happening that hasn't yet come to light. But trust me, this question right there, the millions of people in these states that refuse to expand their Medicaid programs so that people who are poor can afford to basically satisfy the law, the mandate, this president's mandate that they must have health insurance. What's going to happen to those people? Good question. Well, that is one of the subjects I wanted to talk about today. And I want to move on to this other one about shop and frisk. You know, we've heard the stories about African Americans patronizing kind of higher end stores, Macy's and what's the other one, Barney's, and being given less than pleasant treatment. In fact, being subjected to a kind of shop and frisk. In each instance, there are now four such individuals. They, after making a purchase, they were stopped by police and questioned. In one case, detained for questioning. And the suspicion was that they were using stolen credit cards or fraudulent cards. I have some pretty interesting reactions to that, and I had to think about it. You know, there are two things. It's not news, and I understand how outrageous the conduct is. I'm not excusing that at all, at all. But there are aspects to this that I think need also to be brought to light. And that is that at least two things that I wanted to talk about today. The black leaders who intentionally softened the blow against the offending stores. They kind of act as interlopers. They come in and you know, calm things down, insert themselves into a process, and then begin in their so-called efforts at intervention to systematically dismantle the people's case. I'll get to that in a minute. So I want to talk about that aspect of it, and I also want to talk about these consumers. African-American consumers need to wake up about their economic power and how they choose to use it. Well, you must know that when this became a huge issue, the Reverend Alfred Sharpton came to the fore and installed himself as a kind of middle guy. And basically was saying things like, well, you know, we will have to have some kind of dialogue with Macy's to find out how these things could happen. And we have to have a dialogue to educate them about how to do things differently. And, you know, the whole thing about it's the reaction part of it. The reaction being, well, we're going to make a big fuss about it, and we will threaten protests, and we will threaten boycotts and so forth. And you make a big noise, and soon enough, in predictable fashion, it will die down. And the stores would have literally gotten away with the unthinkable. You know, at nowhere on the planet is it considered a good thing for a business to assault customers, you know, to assault their dignity and to treat them less than courteously. on no place on the planet is that a very desirable way to do business. But there are leaders who have made a kind of career out of this business of chilling the community out, putting the fires out that absolutely need to be burning and burning white hot. Their job should be, let us really get a serious fire going here, because no store in this day and age, nobody doing business in this day and age could ever excuse this kind of conduct on the part of a store. And when it happens, let them go out. Let them hire their PR flex. Let them hire their human resources people. Let them hire the experts and their lawyers and their whole battery of people that they normally would pay money to. Let them hire them to educate them about how to deal with human beings. They have the money, let them go and do their thing. The job of the African-American community is certainly not to educate people who choose to behave this way or businesses that choose to behave this way. That's not our job. Frankly, our job is to put them out of business. That's our job. Adam Clayton Powell used to say that in Harlem when it was clear that Woolworths and literally the whole strip on 125th Street was off limits to local black folks. They couldn't work there. He said, do not support any business where you can't work. And literally brought the businesses down to their knees. That's what you do. You stop playing these games. How are you going to negotiate and ameliorate this level of racism? How are you going to pretend that this is an isolated incident? How are you going to pretend that this isn't the culture, that this is the way these stores perceive the community, perceive the African-American consumer? It was distressing in a way to know that, you know, young people making such crazy choices in a way. I mean, people are free to spend their money how they wish to, but you have a young guy who's going to college, and I really think that that's fantastic. But really, will you pay as a college student, unless things are really different now with college students, you're paying $349 for a belt because it says Ferragamo? And you're so label conscious that you're willing to part with almost 350 of your dollars to buy a belt. And you're a regular guy from Queens. I'm not trying to tell you what your style ought to be. I'm just saying that you're willing to do that. And the instruction comes really from the people who are, you know, the points of reference for this kind of outrageous spending, this conspicuous consumption, these hip-hop artists who have money to burn, and they literally, you know, love the idea of displaying their wealth in particularly obscene ways. Look what I have. Look what I could do. I could blow $50,000 in a night just entertaining people, that kind of thing. And so the message gets transferred to an age group that looks upon that as something to be desired. And then there was one young woman who purchased a bag for $2,500. And I'm going, excuse me. You would put $2,500 in a bag and you're not earning, say, $5 million a year? I mean, if you're earning $5 million bucks a year and so forth, you could blow $2,500 on a bag if you wish to. But it's not like these people have unlimited resources. These are people who are counting their pennies. But this is the way they choose to spend their money. And it is a sense to me, it betrays a sense that the community needs some serious education about the power of its dollars. Do you know that the African American community is the largest consumer segment in terms of spending in the United States? The people who are seen generally as poor, okay, unable to do this much of spending, this particular community outshines every other community in terms of its spending power. The forecast is that by 2015 or to 2017 at the latest, African Americans will be spending, hold on to your hair, $1.3 trillion in buying stuff. $1.3 trillion. And yet, you know, we said, my God, there's a disconnect here. How could you hand over $2,500 of your dollars for a bag? It's not like you expect to hold on to that bag until your great-grandchildren are born. Because, of course, styles change. You have to be up with the styles. But these are the choices younger people are making. Older people, too. Unwise choices like this. And, in fact, they are aiding and abetting their own exploitation and oppression. And this is the moral of the story of Shop and Frisk. The internal work that the community has to do to reorganize its priorities, reorganize its thinking, reorganize. I mean, the young man who bought his belt and the young lady who bought her $2,500 purse were both accompanied by their parents, okay, to their lawyers. Which means these are not grown adults. These are not grown people who have reached the age where they can spend the money the way they want to. They're still going with mom and dad, still had to accompany them down to the lawyer. They couldn't afford on their own to hire a lawyer. $2,500 certainly would have been able to hire a lawyer, a reasonable one, a retainer at least. But there's some really important lessons there that we continue to feed into this huge machine, $1.3 trillion, the largest consumer spending segment in the United States. Whoever would have thought that? But this is the way it has been for many years. And it continues. But I want to come back to these self-assigned gurus who step in. I remember many years ago, I can't recall the exact year, when the New York Daily News was being sued by a group of African American reporters and editors for racial discrimination. In the end, the paper was the first paper to be convicted in a federal court of discrimination. But the Daily News was, in fact, heralded and given a dinner and given a top award by none other than the National Association of Black Journalists at its big dinner. And then it was learned later that the Daily News actually paid for it. These journalists should have been the buttressing support for the journalists who were suing. Instead, the leadership of the organization decided it will take the heat off and accept money from the Daily News to undermine the legitimacy of the people who were fighting. And I took that quite personally, because at least two people I know or knew committed suicide. And this is the kind of thing you have. You have these stores that are behaving in this way, which is consistent with institutionalized racism, which is not, this is not a new complaint, by the way, of stores following people around. I mean, even the president said it happened to him. So this is not new. The strategy here as a leader would be to absolutely bring the guillotine down and chop it off, chop this evil head off. Stop with the talking and the ameliorating. But there's money to be made. There is money to be made. And so rather than say, we've had it, this is the end of it, we will use this as an example because we will not tolerate this anymore. We have had too many years, too many decades of supporting people and asking them to respect you. Do everything you can to just put them out of business. That was one of the lessons, by the way, out of the Montgomery bus boycott. After conducting a successful campaign for more than a year, that brought the buses in Montgomery to its knees, the municipal bus system to its knees. The logical thing to have done would be to boycott them forever. Start your own bus business. You proved that you could do it. Put them out of business. And so this is the treatment that these businesses ought to have. But we also need to have a serious assessment about the role of leaders who go into this as if they are like hired hands. They come in to kind of keep the black folks in check so they don't get too angry and assist, you know, give the white owners and the CEOs of these businesses a kind of credibility they do not deserve. They don't deserve it. Bringing them into a community. And then we have people like Jay-Z, who is launching his line of clothing and whatever else at Barney's. He's saying, well, I will give 25%, and then he changed it. And he said, no, I'll give all the proceeds of sales of my product line to my foundation to help, because it gives educational scholarships to African-American young people. It's, you know, we get this kind of thing. In other words, it does not deter him from doing business or giving a partnership, forming a partnership with a store that treats African-Americans this way. It's money. So of the two things, I would say, beware of the leadership, because it's there as a paid agent to dismantle righteous indignation and righteous anger and righteous protest. It is there to soften the blow and give these businesses the veneer of legitimacy in the African-American community, which it holds in contempt. And we have to look at this also as an instruction, especially to younger people, about the role that they are playing in their own annihilation. You're supporting. Why would you throw $349? I could take you to a guy in Harlem who will make you a wonderful belt for not even, what? A reasonable price. A very wonderful belt. but, you know, Ferragamo and whatever the pocketbook is that is such a great attraction. Oh, I tell you, we got lessons to learn. And the last thing I want to talk about before we go to a break is embedded journalism. I wanted to talk about CNN in particular. The whole notion of embedding reporters came about, of course, as a result of the war. And the government decided that having reporters cover the war, doing whatever they do by themselves, would not be working to their advantage. So they came up with this idea back in the Iraq War to have journalists embedded. In other words, they will be controlling these journalists. And in return, the journalists get, quote, access, unquote, and they'll be able to look like they're in the thick of it all and whatnot. Meanwhile, everything they do is monitored by the government. In fact, they had to sign papers before going on embedded missions that they agree and not to reveal this and not to reveal that and not to to obey the orders they give him and so forth, that journalism would be permitted journalism. Well, I've been watching CNN's coverage of the typhoon and the aftermath in the Philippines, and it's amazing. And it was uniformly depressing. Not just at CNN, but particularly CNN, because it's supposed to be a bastion of liberalism. Now, first of all, the story, no matter how big it is, a story has to wait. It only begins to unfold. It becomes important only after the star arrives. The star, in this case, is Anderson Cooper. And until he arrives on the scene, it really isn't a great story, not a big story. The star has to arrive. So we have this notion in the United States that it's the star who is the star and not the news. In my version of journalism, it's the news that grabs the attention. It isn't the star, but we have this notion, this Hollywoodization of news. And in no instance did I see a Filipino face, suggesting that A, there are no journalists in the Philippines who could tell their story themselves and relate their story to the world, considering they have incredible expertise in this area of disasters. And this isn't the first typhoon. It happens to be the worst, but they're accustomed to covering their own country. You would think that CNN would have the grace, if not the logic, to extend journalistic fellowship to journalists in the Philippines to help cover the story, not for CNN's sake, but for the consumer's sake, so that we will know. But because information has to be controlled, and especially by someone white, because it was an all-white team that I saw, not one Filipino face, not one Filipino reporter. And this is par for the course. And they use these kinds of things, I must say, as these are resume attractions, you know, when they write the resume. Oh, I covered this and I covered that and I went there and I covered the other. And they do all of this because they literally have monopoly on it. It's not that because they have specific expertise in this particular area, or that they have unusual contacts, or that they're even willing to trek outside of the luxury of their hotels where they're living, as opposed to the misery that people are living in. They're not into that. They will venture there for the cameras during the day and retreat to their luxurious or comparatively luxurious accommodations in the evening. But their whole intent also is to buttress the propaganda of the United States, to make it to the story is concerned what U.S. soldiers are doing. And we see this kind of narcissism, this nationalistic narcissism, also when you look at, say, the Olympic Games. You would think there are no other athletes participating in the Games except just the Americans. That's all you need to pay attention to. You forget the rest of the world. They're not there. And every single reporter toes the line. They seldom do really elaborate interviews with athletes. So this is a world affair. But they are embedded literally as an extension of the propaganda arm of the U.S. And this was particularly disappointing with CNN. The liberals at CNN simply cannot part with the egotistical needs to dominate the story, to dominate the information, to have it almost commodified. If it isn't Anderson, Gordon, just holding sway, then it isn't a story. They will have you believe that there's nothing they're not expert at. They know everything. And I think it is, in fact, not only very, it is insulting as a journalist to the journalistic community that you would go to the Philippines and not assign or seek fellowship with journalists in the Philippines to cover their own country. They did it in Haiti after the earthquake. In every major disaster, you would not see a reporter who was born and raised there or who has a particular standing in the community, because there is a fear of losing dominance. And that's what they all want. The stars of the cable news and the other news networks, they want to dominate the news. The news is them. I'll take this break, come back to your thoughts at 888-874-4888 right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead, and your calls at 888-874-4888. Steve from Michigan, welcome.
Yes, well, thanks as always for your show and for the entire network. It's a vast wasteland online and in regular radio without PRN. I call NPR National Propaganda Radio now. But I'm a little bit slightly off topic, but I just saw 12 Years a Slave. Have you had a show devoted to that?
No.
Well, it should be mandatory, and I wish President Obama would just go on TV and say, I have one short sentence for all Americans. Go watch the movie. It's an indictment. And it always makes me laugh as a white male Southerner when I hear my colleagues, some of whom have PhDs and stuff, saying that the effects of slavery and racism should be over and that it's all the African-American community's fault what their problems are. And I'm like, take a look at the genocide and the suffering depicted. Even Django Unchained did a little bit of it, but this movie is, number one, it should win all the Oscars that it's nominated for. It's astounding. But the history, it's a true story.
Yes, and I know the story. You know, the thing is, I have to steel myself to go see movies like that, because invariably I leave the movie so angry that it takes a long time for me to calm down. Usually that's my reaction, so I usually have to build up the courage to go and see movies like that.
Yes, I'm in Michigan, which I don't know if you know, away from Detroit. Michigan has KKK and militia and a lot of backwards people, believe it or not. And I'm in a theater. There was maybe 10% of the audience members were African American, and they were weeping. The movie makes any fair-minded person angry and shocked, and it just is such a history lesson delivered so perfectly by every actor and actress in the film, and it's just a powerful, powerful indictment of what humans do to each other when they have power and racism combined.
Absolutely. But thank you, Steve.
Everyone can see it.
Thank you so much for calling in today. Thank you.
Thanks for your show, Utrice.
Thank you. DX from L.A.
Hello, Utrice. How are you
Hello.
Today?
Hello. Fine. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. I'm sitting here thinking about if I can afford a $400 bill. I probably could, but I wouldn't buy it. See, this is the nonsense that we really need to get a hold of. I mean, I've said it before, the black community, unfortunately, we're so susceptible to this materialistic notion that you got to have, you know, this, you got to have that, and that's what makes you this and that. You know, your status is improved by what you buy. And it just ticks me off, irritates me so much. I don't know when or what it's going to take. You've said it before, black community especially has had enough, has had enough things happen to them where we should be out in the streets or whatever we're going to do. We should be outraged. But yet here we are giving these corporations trillion dollars every year, I think it is, and participating in our own continued enslavement and continued abuse. And these people are, it's just ridiculous to me that you would go fight with a lawyer to get someone to take your money for overpriced products. It makes absolutely no sense.
You know, I just want to read you this. This is where I got these figures from, the University of Georgia's Seelig Center for Economic Growth. Just last year, this is just last year, in New York, the African-American community spent $95 billion. Texas.
Oh, my God.
$86 billion, California, $76.7 billion, Florida, $74.4 billion, Georgia, $73.4 billion, Maryland, $63.4 billion, North Carolina, $48.1 billion, Illinois, $46.6 billion, Virginia, $44.9 billion, New Jersey, $40 billion. That's just that's just last year.
I think we've hit upon why also African Americans have the lowest wealth in this country, meaning owning property, owning stock, bonds, these type of things, things that are going to improve your life and your children's lives. I mean, this is why we have, I believe, the lowest college enrollment rate. We're not saving, we're spending. And this is what ticks me off so much. It's just ridiculous to me. I want to thank you for having this show today. I'm going to go calm down.
Let's blame Steve for I blame Steve for me getting me up all upset, and you can blame me in turn for getting you upset.
I love your show, Utrice, but one last thing I wanted to say. As always, I advocate nonviolent revolution. Peaceful revolution where we just divest from this whole society. And it looks like if my message ever takes hold, black people will be the last ones. And I am African American myself, but black people will be the last ones to come along with it. We need to divest from this whole corporate, phony election, corporations, all this stuff. We need to divest and just let them just. Because you're right about the economic power that black people have, but I agree they should recognize it, they should wield it, but also what we should do is just reject all of that, but I don't know if it's going to happen. Anyway, I'm going to go calm down.
And there's so many, and there's so many artisans doing such incredible work. I mean, running rings around Ferragamo. Are you kidding me?
Right, exactly.
They're doing fantastic things. Go seek them out, support them.
Right, like you said, you could take him to one part of New York and he can get a belt made for what? $50, $100, and it'd be better than that belt.
A heck of a lot better.
Yeah.
I mean, we got to learn how to do this. You know, when I was a kid growing up, at the age of seven in our family, you got two things as a kind of gift. All right. This is how you know that you're growing up. You get a passport, and you get a bank book. That's what we got.
Yeah,
and you know, it was a great feeling. You have your own little bank book. Are you kidding? This is great. But we have to do a better job at educating people about the use of their dollars. What's appropriate? What's the best use of your dollar?
Well, you got people like Russell Simmons and Jay-Z, like you mentioned, and Kanye West, and this one and that one, saying, "Go buy this, and it'll make you." You know, this status, it'll make you like me. And we listen to that too much. I mean, these people are total and complete. Most of them sell out. They're just looking for the corporate dollar. Wow. Now you got me worked up again.
Okay. Have a lovely evening, Dex. Put a nice back on your forehead. You ought to be all right in about half an hour.
You. Have a good day.
Well, we've come to the end of our program today. And I wanted you to think about these things. I was very happy to play those the litany of promises by Barack Obama about how he was going to present Obamacare to the public. We would have this open dialogue and discussion and whatnot. Not even the Republicans in Congress saw this bill. So, you know, I tell you. Politicians are really remarkable, remarkable species. That much is true. Thank you, Stephen DX, for calling today. Tomorrow, of course, it's open forum, and we're going to be a little bit focused tomorrow on our open forum. But, of course, it still is open to your views, and you do get to take the conversation where you want it to go. So we're not going to change that too much. But we'll just have a little, you know, tighten it up a little bit tomorrow. All right. So thank you so much for listening. You can always reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook at Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. Thanks again for listening.